What does the new day look like when it comes to our adaptation to climate change? What messages are being communicated through media, politics, and culturally, and are they scientifically sound? Do we understand the great and growing divide when it comes to the impact of climate change on marginalized communities? Isn't it critical that diversity, equity, and inclusion matter and need to be a part of any proposed solutions because we are all part of the solution? Lots of questions to explore on this episode of Impact Earth, so you will want to stay here with me. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Climate Reality. Honestly, can't think of a better, more qualified, more articulate, and I think fun guest to address issues around adapting to climate change and the critical importance of strategic communication and advocacy than our guest today, Eric Kaplan. He is the founder and chief communications leader at Kaplan Communications. Since 2004, Kaplan Communications has worked on the front lines of advocacy and journalism in Washington, D.C. to design cogent messages and news coverage proactively and in rapid response for nonprofit organizations and coalition. Eric is a seasoned chief communications counselor, and I love that term or that moniker. His track record has advised mission-based nonprofits, legislative agendas, and corporate clients, and quite successfully. Eric, it's great to finally connect with you, and I hope you are ready to rock this because I am. I know I'm going to be throwing quite a bit at you, seeking your wisdom.
I am so glad to be with you, and I hope I get anywhere near your target. So this sounds like a pretty high climb, but the good part is we're doing it together. And I really am looking forward to learning from you and hearing where you're coming from. And I hope there are things I can share that that your audience and yourself and me and you know, just all of us can benefit from.
I know you can. So it's like anytime you and I talk, it's very hard to get off the phone. So I think that we connected almost 7 years ago. It might be longer. And I can't help but reflect on how dramatically things have changed in the climate change, climate adaptation, climate resilience space since we first connected. All of the conversations have changed from where I sit. So my first question, it is fraught with complexities and the possibilities for answers, but we have to start somewhere. And it's a simple and complicated question both at the same time. From where you sit, where are we as a country when it comes to any kind of direction or platform or strategy when it comes to adapting to climate change? Are we on the right track?
We are close to the right track, and I think you deserve a very straight answer. So I would like to think we are. There are forces that would deter or distract or complicate or politicize. But the most important thing, I think, is what scientists and government and industry and individuals and students and investors, other, we all play a role in this. And the key, I really think the key to saying, yes, we're on the right track, is that we're working in concert and that we all, like a puzzle, fit. We don't do each other, but we do, in the moment, we do what we are supposed to do to contribute to the bigger picture.
That's really a great answer. And part of that, it speaks volumes about the role of government, because I have had so many guests where we go back and forth. Is it a people challenge and people need to take power into their own hands? Or is it a policy issue where legislation is, you know, absolutely necessary? And when it comes to climate adaptation, I can't see us going forward without a strong role in government. And I'm not a big government person, but in this case, we need government leadership. Is that something that you agree with some kind of, like you said, cogent policy for how we're going to get from point A to point B?
Well, the definitive answer is yes. But getting to yes can be complicated. And beside what we might think or be pre-programmed to think this way. But you mentioned a moment ago the role of government. And I think depending upon, say, who's in power or who's out of power and how that's leveraged, you know, suddenly government is in the way, or suddenly government is the way. And I think it's about the people. So I'm going to prove to you in less than a few sentences why it's about the people. And the people tell the stories, and the stories are the why, and not the what, but the why we do it, and why we do it this way and not that way. So let me take a step back and put it in just very basic two or three sentences. Number one, the question for me is it rugged individualism or is it collectivism? And in a nutshell, there are some, depending upon who's in power, who would like, and this isn't a political conversation, it's simply the reality that I, the individual, should be the captain of my own ship. And I need to do what I need to do. And then you have a different philosophy that says, you know, we need to do things because we are all connected. And I don't mean in this kumbaya, you know, let's all hold hands at the beach kind of cook.
But we are.
But we are. And to deny this would be to deny that, you know, just for example, if I got a haircut today, and everybody in the place is wearing a mask. And in Maryland, if you're vaccinated, fully vaccinated, even with the current situation, they say, you know what, it's still kind of the honor system. If you're not vaccinated, you need to wear a mask. And then if you go into different businesses, different signs are on the door. So if I go grocery shopping or I get a haircut, whatever it is, go to the bank, I just don't want someone to feel vulnerable. And so I say to myself, you know what? Yes, as an entrepreneur, as a former journalist, as all the different hats I, father, husband, whatever I want a hat, I'm still wearing the mask because I feel that it is sort of the moral obligation to be with the program. And that doesn't mean anyone's drinking any Kool-Aid, but others can be hurt. Others can be impacted. Others can feel vulnerable. And we don't know, you know, what everyone's story is. So the collectivism would simply say, you know, what's good for everyone, I can play by those rules. And I don't put my needs or my rules or my standard above your standard. So there are, really politics aside, there are a lot of folks that just see, say, the role of government as an impediment or an obstacle or a hoop to jump through or something. And you know, that's not been my, you know, I'm not all that old, but as long as I've been around, you know, government is there to be the backstop, to be the, you know, the kind of the safety person. And you know what? It's not to be, as some might say, you know, Ronald Reagan famously, you know, joked that, you know, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And everybody says, oh, that's funny. And they applaud as if that was their, you know, reflexive thing to do. And you know what? They're tremendously valuable things that government does. I'm not a big government guy, but I do know that industry and things just don't get better on their own unless we're all on the same page. And that works for COVID too. So yeah. I don't want my answer to go on too long, but I will say that if you have a balance between the rugged individualists about us and the collectivists about us, there's a mutual respect and civility that I think I'm obligated to do. And so there's a frame to look at climate and most other things that, you know, is it all about me? Or is there a way that we can get there together? And that's where I'm a little more inclined to think that my actions have reactions. And those reactions, you know, I'm not on an island. It doesn't work that way. And I'm willing to respect other people.
So it's a perfect segue, and I thought about this a lot. Should I put this question in? Should I not? But it's just with what you brought up and with what I see as some similarities in terms of national policy and directives, what similarities do you see about what we're doing with climate action and climate policy and how we're going about defeating COVID? Talk about a mixed bag and rugged individualism and the free market. What's your sense of, to me, we have to get both of those right. Let's just be honest. That's my feelings. We have to get both of them right. And it's going to be everybody holding hands. And if you want to sing Kumbaya, welcome. But if not, we got to all be pulling in the right direction when it comes to climate change and COVID. So what are your thoughts? I mean, you're on it. So what does your conventional wisdom say about, are there similarities in what we're doing?
You ask a really important question. And I think leading an organization like Kaplan Communications makes me particularly aware of those around me and what clients ask of me and the work we take on and the work that may not be appropriate or we don't necessarily believe in or we would not represent. I feel journalistically a real responsibility. And so when I think of journalism and advocacy, and as you mentioned in the introduction, generously, looking at the arc of our company and the work that we do and the whether they're authors or public health or conservation organizations, anybody in it that's concerned with social justice or otherwise, they're looking, in my opinion, they're fighting for issues in the public interest. And so it's a lot, not on my shoulders, it's a lot on the shoulders of organizations that we work with. So the best way I think I can answer your question is to say that we as individuals and as organizations, whether you are working for a company or you are a business owner or you're a teacher, or you drive a truck, whatever your place, we have a really consequential role to play in each other's lives. And I think being able to communicate this and being able to have some journalistic integrity, that's where I come down, because there are a lot of folks, sort of hired guns, if you will, maybe a bad analogy, but I'll use it.
Too. It's like, oh, I probably shouldn't use that phrase anymore.
You know, another one I want to get rid of is drilling down. Yeah. Who the heck ever came up with, I want to drill down.
We don't want to do that one either.
No. And there's another one that I don't use anymore, I won't even mention. but it's a noun and is a verb, and I won't do it because of the T. So my point is that I want to make sure when we talk about things that are journalistic, they are accurate, they're true, and they're complete. And if you can tell a story to two people or 20 or 200 or 2,000 people, if you can tell a true, accurate, and complete story, you're likely working on something that can benefit certain audiences. Or stakeholders.
Right, right.
Or neighbors, or students, or whomever you're connecting with. And being in that role is a very, whether you work in the media or you work in, you know, healthcare, you're on the front lines of COVID. I remember as a young child, you know, hearing about veterans that had come back from Vietnam. Or, you know, even the Gulf War later in life. And now, you know, with the war on terror and the end of this current war that's been closed down here in the last couple of weeks after 20 years, people are, you know, experiencing a different kind of PTSD. And these are our healthcare frontline workers that never knew that they would be, you know, confronted with this variant or with this pandemic or with the demand or with the really ugly, nasty behavior that some people portray, whether they're on an airplane or at a grocery store and they don't want a mask or whatever. And that takes me back to kind of the collectivism versus the rugged individualist. And the last thing I want to say about it, frankly, is that there's a song that says, you know, if you choose not to decide, you still made a choice. I think we need to live in the moment. I think we need to live by our wallet, where you shop, what you buy, how you use products, where you dispose of them, what you consume, what you don't. And these are active choices. And you know what? If you choose not to decide, you're still making a choice.
Right.
And
right.
it's having an impact on everybody.
Right.
And so I would rather be a part of that solution. I'm not perfect, but I certainly want to try to help other people find answers. And you know, if like science, if we find new data, if we can assess things with more clarity, then it gets better. And we actually learn from those experiences. If we don't, we get to, unfortunately, repeat those failures.
Right, right.
But that's where I think our conversation might go today. Because if we're talking about climate, it can be a metaphor, or it can be, you know, it can be a really concrete thing, looking at the wildfires out west and the droughts and the flooding. And, you know, these things are about preparedness. And we didn't know, really, that we needed to prepare for this pandemic. But now that we're in it, and now that some of us are sort of emerging from it, and people are putting their lives and their careers back together, I think we need to help each other and not just be an island. And to correct the thing people have been saying for decades about no man is an island, well, I think we've learned in the last 18 months that no person is an island.
Right. We want to get rid of some of those expressions, if you're me, no man is an island. There's a lot of them that think they are.
You know, exactly. And you make a good point, because it's not about waiting for the next person. It's about doing the right thing.
Right.
The first time.
And the thing to me is that so the glaring similarity about climate change and COVID mm-hmm. is that if you just step back and think, literally step back and think, the reality is climate change and COVID could care less about how mm-hmm. you voted in the last
Correct.
Election, how you're going to vote in the next election. They are both ruthless, unrelenting, moving mm-hmm. forward. So to me, it's such an opportunity to unify people, to have right. one voice, to don't we want our country to be healthy? Don't we want to adapt to climate change? So I love that question because, as you have said, I mean, there is no rugged individual in this, because COVID didn't get that memo that you were a rugged individualist, which you still can be, but you're still part of a community. So I really appreciate your answer. And it's, of course, a perfect segue to the next question I have. It's like we rehearse Please. This. And I call this, like, there's a big bowl of soup out there when it comes to climate and science and climate deniers. Mm-hmm. And some of the biggest name climate science leaders that I've interviewed or that I've read about, they don't even engage with climate deniers anymore. And I think mm-hmm. about when we started, we were about raising awareness about climate change and blah, blah, blah. We don't even say that anymore. If you're not aware of climate change, you probably shouldn't be listening to my podcast. And I say that with love and kindness. I mean, climate change is. Turn on the news, look at the weather, and there you have it. I don't have to get into any big conversation about that. But do you weigh in, or do you even address any of the climate denier conversation about the science? Because it is so science-driven. Yeah. I remember I asked Catherine Hayhoe, who is one of the leading women climate scientists, when I was on an interview with her. She said, I don't even want to answer that question. I refuse to be on panels or be on TV or be interviewed in any format whatsoever. And this was, I think I interviewed her 4 years ago. She said, I ignore them. There's no space in my life for that type of ignorance or something. It was a very harsh answer, but very true. I wanted to cheer. So what is your thinking when it comes to deniers who question the science?
Well, let me take a bit of a pivot off of Catherine Hayhoe. Tremendous respect for her. Not 5 or 6 years ago, we met for coffee here in Washington. Had a pleasure of working with her on a number of things where she lent her voice, she lent her passion, she lent her faith. She's lent a lot of her experience to fighting climate change and to validating the climate action movement altogether. But let me answer the question just a little differently. And it's a very, very quick story where I was called maybe 2 or 3 years ago after we launched a new website at the time, I remember. And I heard from someone who said, hey, I'm trying to put together a debate. And I said, oh, okay, well, great. Well, if I can help you, I'll help you. How did you think that I could help you? And he said, well, I saw your website. And I said, oh, we have just launched a new website. He says, well, I didn't see the old one. I said, okay, well, what can I do for you? He says, well, I saw your client list. And he said that you work with a lot of organizations that are involved in, he kind of alluded to sort of this red-blue debate of climate. And I said, well, first of all, there's no debate. But I have, you know, tangentially, I'd heard people talk about a red-blue debate, and I think it's really nonsense. Why? What do you want to do? He says, well, basically, we think that you can supply all the blue debaters, and we can bring in all the red debaters.
Oh my gosh.
And I said,
I'm sorry.
I know. This is easy to laugh about, but I want you to know, this is just a really casual sort of off-the-cuff conversation. I got the call, and would you like to talk to us? I said, sure, put him through, and here I'm talking to the gentleman, and he says to me, can you do that for us? Can you contribute the blue or the green, however you put it, the blue side of the debate? And I said, is this for education, or is this for science, or is this entertainment?
Great question.
Said, I don't understand. Would you repeat the question? I said, yeah. Are we doing this for science or are we doing this for entertainment? And he said to me, I'm totally lost, man. That's exactly what he said. I'm totally lost, man. Can you help me? I don't know what your question means. I said, you called because on the surface, it looks like I might know people that can support a conservation approach to climate change. He says, yeah. And I said, well, there's no other side to the issue. So you're either doing this because it's science-based or because it's entertaining. And he says, I just don't know what to say. And I said, well, I appreciate your call. And if I can help you, maybe we'll talk in the future. And I was done, and that was it. And now at times, it seems like it was like a 40-second answer and we were off the phone with each other, but I don't know why. It seemed to go on a little bit longer. My point is that this isn't political.
No, it
this
can't
is,
be. We've got to move
this
that
is not
conversation.
Ideological.
Yeah.
Right. This is, there are a number of ways we can get there. Are you a veteran? Well, there are a lot. I've met in my work, I've met a lot of, you know who tells great stories? I mean, really harrowing stories that they didn't know they were going to be telling a story about it someday. You've got people who are veterans who are concerned with national security. You have farmers who didn't know they'd be trapped in the middle of a trade war in the last administration, let's say. You've got a lot of important men and women who don't really think of themselves as heroes. They're simply called to service to their country. And I would put manufacturers in that position. I would put veterans in that column. I would put farmers in that column. And basically, farmers are probably the biggest small business people, family farmers in the whole country.
Right.
They have had to be more resilient. They have had to be more tactical. They've had to be more creative. There's a farmer that I, just in passing through, because they lent their voice to the work they do in sustainable farms, and there's a farmer that I've talked to, and I feel like I've met these people, and many of them feel like they know me, in North Carolina. He's a blueberry farmer, and he said to me that there are very few parts of my farm that my father or my grandparents would recognize today, because we have had to be so resourceful in how we farm the land, how we irrigate, how we use water, and the fact that we do solar all over the farm. He says, my family would never recognize the place because we have created business revenue. We have created, how did he put it, revenue streams in ways that farmers all over the country are reinventing what being a farmer means. But first and foremost, farmers in the Midwest tell me, I'm a conservationist. I've got to wear a number of hats, but if I can't plant, if I can't, you know, this is not about chemicals in the soil. This is about treating the soil with dignity and raising my family, being able to have a home, and it all comes through the soil. And we're feeding the world, but I'm also, front lines, I got to feed my family. So, I mean, these are stories that just get lost unless, as my grandmother might say, you know, the work you do, you could get a good education.
Yeah, and so go ahead.
And if you're listening to these people, you know, if you're really paying attention to what farmers tell you or what national security folks tell you, they're concerned with how, you know, world powers around the globe are behaving and how they're treating their, you know, their constituents or, you know, their citizens. You know, I read an op-ed today in the LA Times, and I didn't realize until I read it a second time, and I realized it came out September 1st, you know, and it's, you know, been a couple weeks now. And when I think in terms of what China is doing with coal and what, say, Saudi Arabia is doing to desalinate water, you might think that has nothing to do with the United States. But it takes energy to make energy. It takes water to make water. And there are some very, very critical global water crises that countries around the globe are on the brink of. And right. That means that climate is potentially impacting conflict zones that are not just, say, in places that we are familiar with, but they're in Central America, they're in South America, they're in India, they're in they're in Russia. Listen to me, they're in Russia, they're in China, they're all over, and they're here in America. And heaven forbid, but it's true.
It is, and I think
we have climate refugees right here.
We have climate refugees, and I think you know to kind of get us back a little bit on track about the climate deniers. Your answer is that to me, it's. They're getting less and less. Their voices aren't being heard as much because of extreme weather. But the reality on the ground is people aren't even having that debate. They're saying, how do I survive? How do I get my farm in shape? What am I going to do about these floods? Oh my gosh, there's been no rain. So when you're doing your work and making a living, it's not even time to have that conversation. To me, it's a total waste of time because the reality is climate change is here, COVID's here. What can we do about it? So if it's okay with you, I'd like to move on to the next question because I have some great ones.
Please.
So from where I sit, the climate crisis is really not one about preserving the planet. And I think that's a very important nuance, a very important pivot for people to get in their minds because the planet will survive. Hundreds of species are already adapting. Millions have disappeared, sadly, and there's nothing we can do about that. All of which make this what I call the humanitarian crisis, especially here in the U.S. So my question is, do you agree that this is a crisis for people of the planet? And I think the answer is yes. I really don't even have to ask you that. But are some of the things we are witnessing in terms of extreme weather as we speak, are they avoidable? Could we be changing the trajectory right here in the United States? What's your weigh in on that?
The short answer to that is yes. The tough answer is the fact that when the IPCC recently put out their climate assessment.
Yeah, code red.
Okay.
I cracked up. I went, yeah, code red 20 years ago, guys.
Right. So you know, people don't study until the test is tomorrow, right? So in the same respect, so people aren't really ready to act on climate until it knocks at their front door. And then some folks are still in denial that this is actually climate change because that happens someplace else, doesn't happen here. Or I never thought it would happen, or this is the worst I've seen things in years. And those are things that people volunteer to a reporter. We've got Hurricane Ida that came up through the Gulf, and the levees held. And it was, you know, a Category 5, a Category 4 when it hit. And, you know, we were better prepared than we were 16 years ago, almost to the day, if it wasn't to the day. So it is a humanitarian crisis, and it's a humanitarian crisis here because people were displaced, and I don't just mean along the Gulf of Mexico, whether you're looking at Houston or, say, the Alabama coast or the Mississippi coast or the Florida Panhandle. You know, we're not just looking at where, you know, these extreme weather events come on, you know, hit the U.S. mainland. You know, we know New Jersey and New York and elsewhere where more people perished in from the Mid-Atlantic through the New York, Greater New York region, than, you know, combined, than, you know, the folks that were displaced and hurt and killed in the Gulf of Mexico area. And so when I think about this, we know that this isn't even the peak of hurricane season. And right, we're in a position that if you look out west at the at the wildfires and drought, these are things that we can prevent, and we can, you know, but we've got to understand that when your neighbor, you know, there used to be kind of a sick joke that was, growing up in the 70s, early 80s, it's a recession when your neighbor loses a job. It's a depression when you lose a job. So, you know, is it a climate disaster when it happens to someone else or when it happens to us? And I think that we cannot any longer deny that it happens, that it happens more frequently, and the science shows it's more intense. So if you live in California or Oregon or Washington State, for example, and you see, and you have a hard time seeing and breathing, but you see the wildfires, this isn't just hitting some celebrity's ranch, okay? This is displacing people that were getting ready to go to school or getting ready to get their kids ready for back to school, and here they are thrown into a climate disaster. And, you know, it's not just people in other countries that are become climate refugees, but what can we do? Your question is, what can we do to prevent or to forestall or otherwise to mitigate or alleviate?
Or adapt. I mean, adaptation is a huge part of what I think our future needs to look right. like. And there are things we can do. So what would be some of your top recommendations? The fires are a conversation all in and of themselves. And there are things. And I just want to add that what I want everyone to try to understand, I don't say should, it's an invitation, is that the news happens, we see the fires, we see the mudslides, we see this, we see that. So many of those people who have lost their home and their land and there's no possibility of rebuilding, they are from marginalized communities. I mean, if you're a middle class, hardworking, you've got homeowners insurance, you've got car insurance, all of those things, but climate change is really contributing greatly to what I call the Great Divide. I mean, it's we're all paying for it in many ways, emotionally, financially, psychologically. So what are some of your adaptation strategies? Because of all the research you do and what you post, what could we be doing better?
Well, the first thing we should do is consider what we can do individually. And this is maybe where you can be a rugged individualist. This is not about going out and buying a Tesla, by the way. This is not about going out and changing or doing something extreme. What we have to do is understand that, as they say, every action has a reaction. And if I happen, which I actually did in 2005, I bought a hybrid. And I realized after doing my taxes the next year and then after that, and my wife was like, but no, wait, where are all your fuel costs? This is an actual conversation. And I said, no, that was it. So if we are consuming less fossil fuels, we are emitting, whether it's a stationary, like a factory or an extractive, you know, company that's pulling, coal or oil or gas out of the ground, or the emissions that you don't see, like methane, which is literally 80. People say other things, 86, 84, what, 80 times in the next 20 years, 80 times more exacerbating the climate crisis than CO2, which you would get from, say, you know, burning coal or oil or gas. So it's the what you don't see is, you know, the emissions that come from releasing this. And you get, you know, and by the way, the current administration just reinstated the methane rule.
I know. Can you imagine? I mean, I read some of this stuff and I'm like, where am I living? Is this an altered universe?
Right. Well,
alternate universe?
The methane rule that was suspended was, you know, I guess maybe out of sight, out of mind, or hey, this is putting too much a burden on industry. Really? You know, you get methane. Methane is produced from pipelines, from fracking wells, from a lot of things. Also comes from landfills and transfer stations. It doesn't just put off a pretty nasty smell, you know, from those, but it comes from agriculture. It is everywhere. So I think one of the things they can do is they can monitor their emissions. Imagine that. Imagine if they could monitor it and they could capture it, which obviously they do, because they're fracking underground in rocks and they're capturing, you know, another word for natural gas is methane. If you can capture it in order to fuel your, you know, the heating of your home or the cooking from your oven, your stove, you know, if you can capture it, you can profit from it. And that means that you don't have to flare it. Although I'm told flaring, you know, which means you ever see when you're driving at night and you see a flame in the air and, you know, they're burning the excess. But if you capture that, these companies can be much more efficient and much more profitable, I imagine, by actually capturing it and selling that and not just wasting it or having it go up into the atmosphere. But there are things that industry is responsible for, and people can make small changes in their lifestyle and their contributions to the problem. There is such a thing. And you mentioned about COVID before. And one thing I wanted to add to that, just very, very briefly, if I can, is that there is something called CASPER. And it's not like the mattress, or it's not like the friendly ghost, but it's an acronym for cross-state air pollution rule. And people that are deep in the weeds of policy call it the CASPER rule. And what it means is, just like COVID, these emissions, whether they're methane or whether they're, you know, from burning another fossil fuel like coal or oil, these are invisible, okay? And some of them you can actually see because they make smoke, but they don't respect borders. So the cross-state air pollution rule, the CASPER rule, says that you may be living downwind, or let's say you're living east of something to your west, and whether it's in a state that pollutes, say Pennsylvania, my home state, people who are living east of Pittsburgh are impacted more than necessarily the people in Ohio, but the people in Ohio may be impacted by what comes out of Illinois. So you have this constant west to east movement of air. And if you are able to curtail or measure on site, it'd be great to be able to measure and monitor those emissions. Then an organization, say, like the American Lung Association, who is not a political organization, they're a public health organization. They care about people stopping smoking and being exposed, children and adults, being exposed to less dirty air days or unhealthy breathing, unhealthy air days. So if you want to, at any time, I think every April, they put out a new State of the Air report. If you were to go to, say, stateoftheairreport.org, you could put your zip code. Let's say Pittsburgh, downtown Pittsburgh is, as I picked on Pennsylvania a minute ago, 15222, or any zip code in the country. You will see the grade, the scientific grade that they associate because of who is downwind and what they are encountering and what the risk is to public health and senior citizens and children and mothers, everybody. And just to make a really, you know, a clear point, there are things we can do that reduces those emissions. And pollution does exacerbate climate. And if we're less reliant or we have more clean energy options, they're now more competitive. In fact, you know, oil has been outseated by gas, and coal. Coal has been outseated by natural gas or methane because it's so cheap. It's so prevalent. And so my question for you is how can we simply spread the news that the choices are no longer expensive. Now they're more competitive than ever. And I just feel like if we ask more from leadership, you're not going to get industry to self-regulate. It's a great talking point for some people in Congress, but it doesn't happen. So we have to be working off the same page, and we have to be on board with the same rules. And it sort of goes like it would, say, wearing a mask. You know, there are things that are airborne. And if we don't observe common rules, then we're not able to lessen the burden that even the weakest among us, and sometimes the strongest among us, can be impacted and hurt by, if not die because of their exposure, and disproportionately their exposure to fossil fuel development and dirty water and, you know, unsafe air to breathe. This is a really growing problem that we all really have a role in.
Yes, and it's sometimes, this is really sick, and I probably shouldn't say it on air, but there is a human population explosion, and climate change and COVID are kicking butt when it comes to that. I mean, it's very sad, but what's it going to take? And back to the, adaptation strategies, I have an example of one that I may have seen it in the notes that you sent, but it's very real and very recent for me, which is the early warning systems. I was going over to our show producer's home on Friday night for a party, and my phone started blowing up, and it was an alert from the National Weather Service about certain flash flood warnings in our city. And I will tell you what, Eric, I was all over it, looking at the route. I kept saying we can't go in any flash flood areas. And there was sunshine and blue skies in my part of town. So to me, that is a really good improvement that can literally save people's lives. So to me, the climate crisis is not really one of preserving the planet. When I say that, people point out you misspeak. The planet will survive. Hundreds of species are already adapting. Unfortunately, millions have disappeared. That makes this a humanitarian crisis, and especially what we're seeing here in the United States. So are some of the things that we're seeing with extreme weather, are some of them avoidable? Could we be changing the trajectory from where you sit?
Yes, I think they can be alleviated. I think they can be mitigated to a strong extent. One of the ways of looking at this is through the connection that our population has to climate. Some folks will look at the recent census figures and say, hey, we're not keeping up with our growth rate or our, you know, we're not having as many babies or whatever it is. And that's an issue. When the climate side of that might tell a different story, because I think that if we're having fewer children, maybe those children might be having a better quality of life. I'm not telling anyone how many children to have, but I also subscribe to the fact that people should be free to make these choices they want to make. And if I grow up in a family with two children and my neighbor grows up in a family with seven, you know, it's a pretty easy math question to figure out that their impact on water resources and food is very different from my household. And so maybe the quality of life at my home will be different, though they're very good people and have great values and work hard and play by the rules. I think if we look at the climate, if we look at population through the lens of climate, we see different solutions, but we may be watching the same movie. So part of my inclination is to realize that this is not a one-size-fits-all solution to climate. But based on where we drive and what we drive and whether we're, you know, turning lights off when we leave the room or taking 30-minute showers or not, you know, there are different ways that our use of natural resources has a direct correspondence to the climate crisis. And if we are living downwind from folks, and we're producing certain fossil fuels, you know, there are people who are impacted by that disproportionately. Many times they're living closer to fossil fuel extraction. They're living in big cities. They have a different experience. And so I believe that it's really important to see those climate justice storylines and give voice to them in a way that's meaningful, because what we did in the past, and oftentimes conventional wisdom, we find out in the long run, wasn't all that sharp to begin with. And we've got to make small changes in how we use energy, and how energy is derived can easily be adapted and often isn't as expensive as it once was.
So the thread that's going through here, yes, people can be part of the solution every single day. And like you said, every choice you make about what you buy, about where you shop, about what you consume is a choice that helps us get closer to a solution or farther away from it. But then there's things like, I remember when I saw the film Kiss the Ground about regenerative agriculture. And I've stayed in touch with those people, and I'm thrilled to know that they're involved with Schumer's plan for regenerative agriculture. And that's where, to me, the excitement and the opportunity comes, because it can be a win-win-win. People, profit, planet. It's really doable when you talk about how, just look at the farm bill, which could be a whole nother podcast with you and me. But if we shifted some of the way that money is spent in subsidies and helped farmers develop drought-resistant crops and modernizing their irrigation systems. I mean, these are big scale things that will bring about big scale changes. And I remember talking to someone, a really good friend of mine at the University of Arizona, and I was talking about our One Less Straw campaign. And we really went around and around about it. She said, Gina, if everybody in the world stopped using straws today, it wouldn't make enough of a difference. What we have to address is carbon. And as a statement, that's true. But as a reality, I said to her, a straw is a gateway to consciousness, because when someone pointed out the damage that straws do and the CO2 that they create and the transportation that, you know, CO2, more CO2 emissions. So it's like it's this big web of connectedness that we can do as a country and as people, that as humanitarians. So I just, you know, that's my little rant about it. We have to really invest in water infrastructure, because everybody needs clean water. And in the West here, I wonder how much we're going to do. The Navajo reservations, 30% of the people don't have access to clean water. So how do you think that's going to look, you know, 4 years from now after pretty much the summers we've had? So you can respond to my rant, and then I have one more question.
Okay. Well, let me tell you that the carbon issue is massive. And whether we put a price on carbon, which we could do.
Right.
And it could be, you know, sort of the price of doing business. It could be really practical. Or we look at the load that the ground and our water is able to handle when it comes to contaminated water. Think of the phosphorus that comes or runs off from agriculture, whether it's from animal waste or whether it's from, how the animals or plants, what chemicals are put into the earth in order to get rid of bugs and other, pests, pesticides. You know, the cleaner those, using cover crops and using other sustainable food approaches are tremendously showing to leave the earth less contaminated.
Right.
So if you have, if the water is only going to hold so much and the phosphorus starts getting in then you have algal blooms, and look at what happens to whether it's Lake Erie or any local river. There are times where in the summer I can't take my dogs to a local lake because the algae is too intense.
I know, that's terrifying.
They want to swim.
To me.
Right. So we've got to think about, we can either deny it's an issue, thus don't have to fix it, or we can invest really smart ways, which this administration, I'm not a hack for them, but I will say that the current administration has tremendously smart plans to, as they say, build back better. But I think if we look at what it costs to do this, if you and I have homes next door to each other, and we never clean the gutters out, and we never paint and restore the outside of the house, you know, it cracks. It's my house is southern facing, so it gets blasted by the sun every day, and I'm not in Arizona, I'm in Maryland. You know, if we don't do simple things to maintain our bridges, we maintain our waterways, you know, we're going to pay a price beyond our, you know, God forbid, when we have, say, buildings in Miami that collapse because the HOA said, hey, it's going to cost X to fix it. I don't want to. We just did an assessment. I'm making this up. We just did an assessment 3 years ago. Why do we need another assessment? So God forbid these things happen. And we look at each other for rationale or for remedies or for, and you know, you can't go back.
No.
But if
no.
we set a baseline that is healthy, that is affordable, that is practical, and keeps everybody again on the same page, we might be able to survive this really perilous time.
Yeah, from your mouth to whoever powers are listening. And the next question,
right.
it's good. I mean, I have many more questions that I just guess I'll have to have you back, because there's a lot to cover when you're talking about climate adaptation and resilience and all that. So this whole new category of vulnerabilities that has always been there, but is now really being talked about in what I observe to be meaningful ways, and it's around diversity, equity, and inclusion. When I started, and I go back to that, because we weren't talking about that as it relates to the unfair, disproportionate, more harmful impact of climate change on those marginalized populations. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to answer for me. I think I have hope in how we're addressing them just in my community alone, from food security to infrastructure to energy efficiency. What's your read from the national perspective on how are we doing with addressing mm-hmm. the marginalized community issues and their vulnerabilities?
I think we're doing poorly. Sorry to interrupt you. We're doing poorly. The golden rule, I was told as a kid, is that, you know, you do unto others as you would like others
right.
to do to you, or you'd like to have a certain standard. And I feel that there's a kid that wasn't all that popular and not a friend in college that used to joke rather arrogantly that the golden rule is he with the gold rules. And I said, no, that's not right. So I put this in two categories. It's either the rule of gold, which puts us on the other side, or the golden rule. And I think, honestly, that whether you're a person of color, whether you're a woman, whether you're a man, whether you are LGBTQ, whatever category you find yourself in, you're my neighbor. And if you look at me as a guy who leads for about 18 years a strategic communications firm in Washington, D.C., I think of me as this guy who just wants to do things journalistically, who addresses issues in the public interest and tries to do a complete, accurate, true story. And basically, in a nutshell, I'm my brother's keeper. I'm my sister. I have a sister. I'm my sister's keeper. If we're not looking out for each other, who's going to look out for us? And I mean, it might seem idealistic, but I'll own that, because I work and I live in the why. And I think that there's a tremendous number of ways to answer why I do what I do. But it's not by denying someone else's pain or denying someone else's plight. It's about understanding them and having a more inclusive, complete, you know, really holistic approach at living. And that's me.
And that's the humanitarian approach. That's the party that I want to start, the humanitarian party. And I've started working on my next book, and I have to come up with the right name for it. But mm-hmm. there's a part of me that, like, when you're saying this, you're a kind, caring, informed, educated, engaged human being. And you get it, because even if you were an SOB that didn't care about your neighbor, you have to be smart enough to know that what happens to them happens to us. It's just, to me, there's such a logic to this that we're all in this together, whether we want to agree with it or not. I can't, you know, we had a presentation at my Rotary this morning from a person in the College of Architecture at the University of Arizona, and he talked about how minuscule the particulates in the air are that are spreading COVID and the variant and that are other things that are getting people sick. And again, it's like it knows no boundaries. It's not a political issue. And if there's anything I want to try to help before I move on to what my next phase of life might be, it's like, how can we really come together for the common good? Because it's something. If we improve water quality, we all win. If we improve air quality, we all win. And I know from following you on your LinkedIn and all of that, that you totally agree. So I have two questions left. One actually is, are you chomping at the bit to share something that I haven't touched on? Because we've had some great conversation. That's my next to last question.
The answer to that is yes, and I'm going to tell you what it is. I have... yesterday, I posted a comic that I didn't know if I, it's an editorial comic, that I didn't know if I posted before on my LinkedIn. And if you're a listener to Mrs. Green's World, I want to be connected to you with LinkedIn. So if you feel like that's something good, look me up because my name is spelled A-R-I-C-C-A-P-L-A-N, Eric Kaplan. And you find me very easily because there's only one spelled the way I spell it. I have a favorite comic and I posted it, even at the risk that I might have posted before. And it has, like, say, a conference. And a guy in the crowd, he hollers a question up to the podium. And he says, it's a climate summit. It says, what if it's a big hoax and we're creating a better world for nothing?
I get it. Oh my gosh.
Okay. So
who loses in that scenario?
That speaks to me. Right. That speaks to me. That says to me, you know, I'm big with my grandmother. She used to say, if you have to hide it, you know it's wrong.
I actually love that you are. I do.
So this is the world I live in. And this is part of the lens I see things through. So energy independence, you know, sustainability, green jobs. They're not green jobs, they're jobs. And they happen to put a lot of people to work and they are not burning a lot of fossil fuels and they're respectful to water. And you know, you remember how maybe a president or two ago, maybe more, said, you know, we want an all the above approach to energy. And I heard Bobby Kennedy Jr. say something really thoughtful. He says, that's great. Let's do all above the ground instead of beneath the ground. And I thought to myself, you know what? That's really astute. If we do solar, if we do wind, if we do hydro, if we do energy efficiency audits, there are a lot of things above, all above the ground. We can help clean water, have healthier children. There's so much we can do if we work together on it. And some people, my friends at Environmental Entrepreneurs and otherwise, they have found they are capitalists, but they won't do it. They won't invest unless it is a clean result. And I think that's the way it should be. We need to think about what outcome, what are we causing? And it cannot only be a bunch of rugged individualists. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, doing his thing on his horseback. I mean, it's just that's not the world we're living in. I think he was probably a pretty good president. He was aware of our national, federal public lands, and he could be attributed a number of things to. Okay, but this is almost 2022. Okay, and if we want to get to 2022 and beyond, I think we need to work together and work toward outcomes that benefit people, not just you know at the end of my nose, but everybody.
Okay, so that's a really good way to kind of end this up. And it gives me, my last question was, sometimes I think it sounds a little bit pithy, but your answers have been reflective of how I kind of feel. And the question I like to ask people like you is, do you have hope? for our future? And if you do, why is that? What gives you hope? Because some days for me, I'll be honest, I sit there and I read this report and that report, and I interview this scientist, and I read this book, and I think, oh my gosh, there isn't really a lot of hope unless we make drastic changes right away. So what's your what's in your heart?
Okay. I have hope. And I'm going to tell you
very— someone answers that.
I am hopeful. I am hopeful because I have met a number of my daughter's friends who they all graduated university this past spring. So back in May of 2021. And meeting this level of smart, engaged people who believe they can change the world or there's something they can do to fix things. They don't see color. They don't see, you know, the constructs that many of us have grappled with for decades. But you know what they see? They see they're ambitious, beyond ambitious. They see opportunity. They're really smart observers. They're going to be better citizens. They're going to be better parents. They're going to be— they already are the future. But I believe, I am optimistic because when I see— and my son is a junior in college— when I see what he's engaged in, and he's asking better questions than I did back in the mid-80s when I was in college. So this is a really important point, and that is we've put good into this next generation, and they're doing something with it. And if they choose not to, they're still making that decision. So there are good things we can do, and then we can let things go. And it's really in our— it's up to us. And I think if whether you have a child or more, whether you are engaged in your community or not, you know, you can do a little or you can do nothing. It's a choice. And I feel that you can wear a mask or you can complain about masks. You know, you can look at the fine particulate matter you were talking about that people emit themselves that has passed along to other people, unfortunately, COVID. And you can see a correlation between what an industry, you know, a polluter or a mobile, you know, a pollution source like a car or a truck, you know, it is also emitting things into the air that we're taking into our bodies. So to think of this linear is just not realistic. And I think we need to learn from each other. I think we need to respect science. And I think we need to be a part of the solution. You know, we need to be a part of the— we need to be the future we want to see. And if, you know, you don't have to be Gandhi to say that or to believe that, you know, but you might say to yourself, just in closing, you might say to yourself, you know, if I go that way, then that's what it means. Well, take a risk and find that there are a whole lot of people who are less interested in taking credit, but mutually benefiting from better decisions, better choices. And I'm grateful to be a part of your broadcast and to be sharing these ideas with you. And I just have to say that you have tremendous questions and they're only conversation starters. And I know.
It's so frustrating. It's like, okay, let's go off on that trajectory and all of that. But that's
love to talk to you again. I mean, this is just a wonderful conversation that as long as you're willing to have it, I'm willing to be there.
Well, I am really glad that I was willing to have it and that we finally reconnected. And when I come to DC, I will be knocking on your door. It's got to happen this year. So thank you, Eric Kaplan, for our guest. To recap, he is the founder and chief communications leader at Kaplan Communications. And my personal shout out is definitely reach out to him on LinkedIn because it gives me joy. It gives me laughter. It gives me food for thought. It gives me pause because you're out there and bringing us some cogent messages that we need to have as we go on our own journey. So thank you, Eric. I'm sure our paths will cross again.
I know they will, and I'm pleased to call you a friend. Thank you for your time. It's great to be with you.
Same here.